I need to make sure that this is the correct version. There are several versions of this talk, and it's not that some are for particularly invited audiences and some are not. It's just that every time I've looked at it, I've had new ideas about it. I think I have. It's a very kind way of saying that I've got an associative mind. So last week I talked about climbing the mountain, and I finished the talk by telling you this story. We had a kind of team building weekend, the team I'm in at Windhorse, and we went away to Wales and we did some climbing. We went to Clamberis. I don't know whether you know where Clamberis is, but it's a magnet for climbers in Wales. An artist said Ian Jayaraja took some of us, novices, took some of us climbing. And it was a very kind of a good metaphor, I think, for spiritual life. Because the title of that talk was Alone or Together. And when you're climbing, you're both climbing alone and you're climbing together. So they gave us some instruction, not too much, but enough instruction to begin. And we did some preliminary kind of bouldering, as it's called. And then we were roped up. And I saw Jayaraja climb the rock face, and I was kind of looking to see what he was doing, and I was going to do the same, and then I followed him. But actually following him was very, very different than seeing him do it. It was like me and the rock face, and I had an idea of what I was going to do, and then there was my body, and I was in these tight little shoes. If you've ever done any climbing, they put you into these torturous little kind of shoes to climb. And it was going quite well, and then suddenly I moved around the rock face, and there was a sheer drop. And although I was roped up, my heart didn't know that everything was okay. My heart started to kind of pound, and I had that horrible feeling, you know, kind of a long way away when you know you're going to start panicking any moment, and you're trying to keep it down. And I clung on to this bit of rock, which seemed quite stable, and then that bit of rock started to wobble. And Jayaraja is shouting instructions. Well, he's teasing me to begin with, but after that, you can see I'm in no mood for being teased. He's shouting some instructions, and the person who is below me, who's roped to me, is kind of looking, because he's going to have to do this in a minute himself. And, you know, so I was kind of, I had to do it myself, but I was kind of helped. I was kind of alone, but together. And the climbing, that climbing weekend, really brought that home very kind of strongly, that when you're doing something like that, an activity like that, you have to do it on your own, but you're doing it in cooperation with others. I thought it was a very good metaphor as well for spiritual hierarchy, because we got our guide, we got people who were more experienced than us, and we could avail ourselves of their encouragement and their kind of advice. And the lovely thing about that particular experience was learning something new. I don't know whether you're doing that at the moment or whether you've done that recently, but when you're learning a new skill, particularly with something like that, I think, with something as dynamic as that, I just felt so grateful for being taught, for being introduced to climbing. You need to be focused, you need to be mindful, you need to bear in mind others. You're alone, but you're doing it together. And that is, I think, what we're doing in our spiritual life, in our Dharma life. We have to take responsibility for ourselves. Nobody is going to kind of do it for us. And we have to choose. We have to freely choose to do it. You can't be kind of coerced into moving towards freedom, because that's what the Dharma life is about. It's about moving you towards freedom. You can't be pushed into that. Bhante says famously once that you have to be able to say no to Buddhism before you can say yes. So that's the kind of preliminaries, really. That's a little bit of what I talked about last week. So this week, I'm going to be talking about risk. It's a risk giving a talk. It's okay for you guys there. You're just sitting there. You can fall asleep, if you like. You're at the back. I may not notice. I did last week. So what part are you playing in this? You know, here am I. I've sort of left the comfort of the audience, and I'm up here on my own. I'm kind of taking a risk. What are you doing? Well, I'm going to suggest particular things in the talk. I'm going to start though with a quote by Bernard Shaw that I really love. This says to me something about how I want to live my life. He says, "This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world would not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle for me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I have got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." I love that. I love the sentiments of that quote. My life belongs to the whole community. I think we find out who we are by doing, by what we engage with, by what we love, what we struggle with. And I think sometimes the things we love and the things we struggle with are the same things. I'm really interested in people. I really fascinated by people, love people, but they're my biggest struggle too. More of that kind of later. So you don't find out who you are by sitting in a chair watching the TV endlessly, I think, or by sharing things, hundreds of things on Facebook, but by doing things, and especially by doing things with others. Spiritual practice can be seen as a journey. And I've said, to be able to commence that journey, you have to freely choose to do it. You have to decide to do it yourself. And that decision has power. It helps us to develop the strength and the stamina and the skill we will need to proceed and to keep going. But I don't think you have to do it yourself. You can do it with others. That's what the Sangha is about. Now, in modern times, we emphasize, perhaps we overemphasize, the personal over the collective, the private over the collective. There's a real danger in seeing the Dharma exclusively in terms of your own personal spiritual experience. If meditation becomes identified as a whole of Dharma practice, it's easy for this to happen. Sometimes when people are talking about their practice, they mean their meditation practice, don't they? I mean, I do this, although I know the limitations of that, I do that too. But practice is much deeper than that, much kind of broader than that. When you think, most of us, the amount of time we meditate anyway, it's only a small segment. We need to make a whole life into practice. Meditation is important. I want you to understand that that's what I think too, but it's not the whole of the spiritual life. Now, I was reading an article in Tricycle. It's an American Buddhist magazine, and it's by an American Buddhist from a different tradition. And he was warning in this article that there's a danger when Buddhism comes to the West, that we extract those parts, only those parts we relate to. He says we put a high premium on personal experience. So we like meditation and mindfulness, and we tend to discard everything else. We might have difficulty with the tradition, with ritual, devotion, spiritual friendship. He says what goes on in this sort of stripping of assets is that you lose Sangha. And the Buddhist tradition, and in the Buddhist tradition, Sangha is a treasure. It's one of the three treasures, isn't it? The Sangha is the living embodiment of the Dharma. It's the body of practitioners with all their experience, with all their different approaches, with all their different perspectives, with all their struggles and their triumphs, their stories. That is the Sangha. It's the wisdom of the community, like a kind of mighty river rather than just a stream. If we approach Buddhism with that kind of attitude, it just becomes another form of psychotherapy, another form of therapy, another form of kind of personal growth, a tool of personal growth. We become a one-person Sangha, which I think is not only a contradiction in terms, but it loses us that connection with something broad and deep and beautiful, actually, the companionship of those on the path. And I can't envisage a Buddhist life without others, without my friends. I can't envisage a Buddhist life just me practicing kind of meditation. I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have got where I am. And I know that I have still got a long way to go, but I couldn't have got where I am without the support, the encouragement, the frustration sometimes of my friends with me, the love of my friends. And their example of their struggles and successes, because I think as a spiritual friend, you don't just share the Dharma, you need to share what it's like practicing the Dharma. You need to share your mistakes as well as your triumphs. And we need to be able to persevere. Hakuin, who's a great Zen teacher, said that perseverance was the greatest virtue. Well, greater than any virtue or precept, because it's perseverance that makes people great. Just carrying on. I also I love this quote from Samuel Beckett, the writer and playwright. He says, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail again, fail better." When I came to Cambridge years ago, started working at Windhorse, one of the van men told me, it might have been Otter City, told me that if a thing is worth doing, it might have been on an adventure actually, I don't know, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly. And I couldn't get my head around that. Surely if a thing is worth doing, you need to do it well. But if it is a good thing, it's worth doing, however you do it. When we set out to do something we haven't done before, we risk failure, don't we? But what is failure? It's not making mistakes. Surely it's not making mistakes, because we need to make mistakes. We're not going to learn anything unless we make mistakes. When I was in, I went to Kalimpong once, which is a little kind of hill town where Sangha Rinpoche lived for a while. And there's a school there that the movement helped support, of Tibetan and Nepalese children. And they're learning English. One of the things they learn is English. And on the blackboard, they'd got a phrase for today, an English phrase for today. And it said, making a mistake is not a mistake. Repeating a mistake is a mistake. I thought there's kind of a lot of wisdom in that. I don't know about you, but I suspect it's true. That like me, you are imperfect. If you're not, just bear with me. imperfect, flawed beings. That's what most of us are. Perfect people don't need to tread the path. Buddhism, in a way, Buddhists are... by being Buddhists, they are flawed people. We're not perfect people. If you're a Buddhist, you're not perfect. But important thing is not that we are imperfect or perfect, or that we may have doubts. Of course we'll have doubts. Or that we'll get confused. Of course we'll get confused. The important thing is to take a small step forward and then another step. Keep moving forwards. As we move forwards, however slowly, we move into a different place. Einstein, I think, said the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them. So you just, sometimes it's hard to realise that, isn't it? We're in a particular state of mind and we absolutise it. We can't imagine seeing things differently. But you change your position in relation to it and you do see it differently. You've stepped out of that state. I have a friend who I lived with at a retreat centre, Surita. Some of you will know him. He likes to say this a lot, that you need to come out of your comfort zone several times a day to be able to stay flexible and open. He likes saying this to me. I don't know why. And the comfort zone is the zone of habit, isn't it? The zone of habits, routines, well-worn routines, the predictable and the known. If we don't move out of our comfort zone on a regular basis, though, I believe our comfort zone actually shrinks. Life becomes more constricted. You've probably heard of the term burnout. Somebody who's kind of been working too hard, not kind of resting, not recuperating, they may burn out. Well, there is rust out as well. But if you are not kind of meeting challenges, if you're not moving forwards into the unknown, it becomes more and more difficult to do that. I once worked with the long-term unemployed, and that was certainly true for them. Without those daily challenges, just a letter coming from the DHSS would throw them. So without regular challenges, we become incapable of meeting challenge. Our superb human resourcefulness and alertness become blunted. And we have evolved into the beings we are by meeting challenges, both in our environment. We're not meant to be couch potatoes. I saw a documentary recently and it said we had evolved from apes. We'd come down into the great grass plains of Africa and we had evolved into endurance runners. So the human body was basically a running machine and we would run down big game. And I was thinking about this, and inside this jumper is this this superb kind of endurance runner. It's hard to kind of imagine that if you kind of look around town. It's easy enough when you're trying to break out of your comfort zone. It's easy enough to break out now and again, isn't it? New Year's resolutions, you take up exercise, you take up yoga, diet, whatever it is, you do a new kind of class. But getting out of routines is hard. We've done a lot of work to get into those routines. It takes quite a bit of work to get out of them. There's a lot of research that explains why it is hard to break out of them. And why it is good for us to do that. So why is it that we feel so comfortable in our routines and habits? What are the benefits of breaking out of our comfort zone? And importantly, how do we do it? So modern life, not just modern life, I imagine, but modern life particularly is stressful. Our comfort zone is a space where our activities and behaviours follow a routine and a pattern that seems to minimise stress and risk. It allows us, I think, to feel secure, to have some sense of control. But it's odd, isn't it, that it's called a comfort zone, because often the comfort zone is not that comfortable. To be bound by habit and routine is not that comfortable. When I was writing this talk, I'd write a bit of the talk And then I'd have a real desire to distract myself, to go and do something else. And I was kind of thinking about that. When you're bending your mind to something, it's a real prod to reflect, isn't it? And I think, why is that? And for me, moving towards a comfort zone is kind of moving away from anxiety. There's a sort of underlying kind of anxiety very often in life, and I look to not touch that, but to kind of mask that. When you've taken on a challenge, though, that really pushed you, that you really engaged with, it can turn up really amazing results. I'm going to be talking about that in a moment. You can accomplish far more than you think you are capable of. And it can encourage a feeling of wanting to carry on. You want to stretch your muscles kind of further. You feel resourceful. You feel you've got the initiative. You feel kind of bigger. In the Buddhist tradition, the heroic ideal is embodied in the figure of the Bodhisattva. The figure of the Bodhisattva is this great being of energy and resourcefulness and compassion, who worked tirelessly for the benefit of others. One of my favourites of the archetypal Bodhisattvas is Kshitigarbha. Kshitigarbha even willingly goes down into the hells, into the realms of hopelessness. He's the Bodhisattva of lost causes. He goes down willingly into those realms of despair and hopelessness. This can seem rather impossible for us. But there's a particular saying of Sangharakshita's that for me embodies what this spirit is really like. If you compare yourself to one of the great Bodhisattvas, I can't match that. But this little phrase of Bhante seems to hold for me the whole spirit of the Bodhisattva ideal. He says, I will put no limit on what I will do when I am ready and the time is ripe for other living beings. I've missed a word out there, I think. I think it should say, I will put no limit on what I am prepared to do when I am ready and the time is ripe for other living beings. We can do things. We can take on challenges that we're not ready for. And if we push ourselves way beyond our limits, it has a number of effects. Two effects came to mind. One is, the first one, that you will probably fail. You will probably fail. Secondly, it will discourage us from taking on things in the future, which would be such a shame. It's our natural tendency to return to the comfort zone, and taking on too much encourages us to stay there, because failure encourages us in most of our lack of endeavour, I think. But we are living beings, and our nature is to want to grow. And if you counter that, unhappiness follows, I think. Last week I was talking about the importance of the context, and that context is other people. If we're not sure, in Bhante's phrase, that we are ready, or the time is ripe, well, we can ask our friends. We can ask our friends who know us what they think, for their opinion. But the attitude in principle of putting no limit on what you are prepared to do for others is one that will encourage you, I think, to keep moving beyond your comfort zone and therefore to keep growing. And to do with thinking about this kind of comfort zone, I was thinking that it isn't just about doing more things. It isn't just about doing really kind of challenging things, taking on more responsibility at kind of work or whatever. It may be moving towards love It may be moving towards expressing a connection and love for others. I don't know about you, but sometimes there are people in my life that I really love, that really mean a lot to me, and I don't tell them enough. I don't allow myself often to kind of think about that. Now, if you know me, you'll be maybe surprised by that. You might think, well, I'm quite expressive in that kind of area, but I feel the kind of the lack, the resistance inside. Sometimes when I'm asked to do something, my gut response here, there's a voice that says, no, you know. We've got a day retreat coming up. Do you think? No. Could you help out? No. And these days, I don't stay with that. I suppose because of the whole momentum of my life. I start with no, and I usually end up with kind of yes. Maybe there's a maybe in between. And if I say no, and I used to get away with it, if I say no and I can do something, I am ready, the time is ripe, I feel I've let myself down. I feel somehow kind of tightness. I feel as if I've kind of, I don't know, hampered myself in some way. I think some of us, though, are too comfortable in busyness. So when I talk about going beyond the comfort zone, if you already are addicted to activity, if you're already kind of like being kind of, very busy, well, you going beyond your comfort zone might be taking more time to decide things. It might mean taking more kind of periods of not doing, of just kind of sitting. So people are different. People's comfort zone is different. It looks different, and moving out of their comfort zone will mean different things to different people. Unfortunately, when you give a talk like this, you've got the whole batch, you know. So it's a bit like when you're leading meditation, you say to some people, if you're falling asleep, kind of open your eyes. They never do, or hardly ever do. Some people are restless, so people need kind of different advice. So when I say encouraging you to move beyond your comfort zone, you need maybe to talk to your friends about that. What is your comfort zone? So yes, moving out of the comfort zone is not just about doing more things. And once you start stepping out of your comfort zone, it gets easier over time. You can hear endless Dharma talks, come to all sorts of retreats and study seminars. And these are very important, I think. But you learn best when you put it into action. When you have to do this because you've committed yourself to it. We learn best when we simply have to learn. In my life as an automobile, I've led thousands probably of study groups. And I'm really interested in how we learn. How do we learn things? What is the point in going to a Dharma study group if it's not going to make any difference, you know, to your life? The Dharma isn't really about learning more information. It's about changing your life. How do we do that? How do we learn? And I think each of you will have a different take on that. We'll have a different kind of learning process. A really good question to ask yourself when looking at your comfort zone is, what scares you? What do you avoid? Are you expending more energy avoiding it than it would take to turn towards it? So what scares you? I think if you remember only that from this talk, going away and just thinking about that, if it's not too scary, actually just thinking about what scares you can do that, can't it? What do you avoid? Sometimes with myself, I try and stay ahead of what is scaring me, you know, my anxiety. And I've learned through meditation and Dharma life that if I stop and turn towards it, it's never as bad as the running away. The running away, it sort of looms bigger. It's kind of the shadow. Seems to, maybe only a little mouse, but it seems like a kind of a big monster. So do you take risks? What are the risks you've taken in your life so far? What is a risk? And when was the last time you took a real risk? I don't mean just doing something for the adrenaline rush, as a break from maybe the safety and tedium of your life. I imagine plenty of people do sort of dangerous kind of things, because life is, their ordinary life, maybe their working life, is so dull. So are the risks you take for pleasure, or are you seeking something else? And it seems to me there's a world of difference between pursuing excitement and real risk taking. When you take a real risk, you're not after a temporary buzz, but you want to push the barriers back. You want to step into no man's land, the unexplored, the unknown. By pushing into the unknown, you find out about yourself. You find out about life too. I remember a few years ago there was a Windhorse pilgrimage to India, and I'd never wanted to go to India, but I felt as a Buddhist, you know, I should. And I thought, okay, I can grit my teeth for 3 weeks. You can't grit your teeth for 3 weeks, actually. And I'll go to India. And I was scared about going. I don't like spicy food, and I don't like hot weather. And I don't particularly like kind of crowded places, you know. I mean, and that is, large parts of India entail that. And what really surprised me was I loved it. I loved it. Coming back was difficult. The reverse culture shock was difficult. I loved being in India. I loved children. You know, being able to talk to kind of children kind of normally, you know. And I loved people coming up to me most of the time, not all the time. Not when I was a bit ill, but saying, who are you? What is your good name? You know, why are you here? People would say that to me. And I remember walking by the river Cam just down the road, and nobody talked to me. You know, I passed all sorts of people. When I got back, nobody talked to me. I couldn't sleep for the silence. The first two or three nights, it was so quiet here. And I remember thinking, when I got off, I flew into another kind of Heathrow. When I flew out, Heathrow was really busy and noisy. And when I flew back, Heathrow was really quiet. And it felt like some dreadful national disaster had happened, and everybody felt really quite mournful in England because of it. And so for me too, risk taking is very linked with adventure. When you push the barriers back, things can happen. All sorts of things can happen. You know, I just sort of discovered a new art of prayer by going kind of to India. I'm going to talk about some of the risks that I've kind of taken now in my life. So you're sitting comfortably, not too comfortably. Staying awake. The back there, good. So at 28, when I was 28, I was living in a small town. I was living in a place near Stoke-on-Trent. I don't know whether you've heard of Stoke-on-Trent, where they make pottery, plates and saucers and toilets and baths and that kind of thing. Or they used to make them. And I was 28, and I felt like my life was running out, as you do when you're 28. You know, you think there is 30, and 30 just seemed like the end. You know, old age was beckoning. When I got to 30, that was it. If I didn't change by the time I was 30, that, I was stuffed. And I got a map out of the UK, and I looked at it with my partner, and we decided that we would try out various cities. And we went to these various cities, and we went to London. I remember I met like a small boy, you know, small town boy. I went to London. I got off the train in London, and it was kind of like that. London just seemed completely terrifying. So we stayed a night, and then we went home. But I ended up in Bristol. I'd always thought Bristol was near Cornwall, but it's a long way from Cornwall. I felt like I was kind of dying of boredom. I've been doing the same job for 11 years. At the weekend, I, you know, got drunk. I got drunk with my friends. That was, you know, it was a very narrow but clearly defined social routine. So I moved to Bristol, and I remember the excitement of packing up my stuff, but then kind of leaving my friends, you know, leaving my kind of old friends behind and going to this place, this new place, new job, new city. I wasn't familiar with it at all. And both scared and excited. I felt I could reinvent myself because I was in a new situation. And it's almost like you get a chance, don't you? For a while, you get a chance to try new things out, but then habit and routine take over again. Within a few days of moving to Bristol, I'd been looking for Buddhism. I had been one of these people, these sort of one-person sanghas in Stoke-on-Trent, only because there were no other Buddhists as far as I knew in Stoke-on-Trent. Anyway, I was interested in Buddhism. I found a poster for Buddhism within a few days of moving to Bristol, and I went along to the centre. And I was so excited. The night before my first class, I was so excited. I felt my life was on a kind of knife edge, you know. I could move towards something bigger, but I didn't know what yet, or I could just recreate the kind of life I'd had in Stoke-on-Trent, but in this new city. And I got involved. I got involved in the Dharma. I learnt meditation. God, it was hard. You know, it was hard to meditate. I remember learning the Metta Bhavana and trying to squeeze out metta. So uncomfortable. It was so uncomfortable sitting in meditation. But I made, one of the things that surprised me, I wanted to find out more about Buddhism, but I hadn't expected to make the kinds of friends I began to make when I contacted the Sangha. I began to develop friendship where I could just be myself. In the past, I'd had to kind of wall off parts of myself. Let me give you an example of this. I was brought up in this small town in Stoke-on-Trent on a council estate. I was gay. So you did not want to be gay living on that council estate. I remember at school kind of trying to kind of walk, you know, in a particular way and smoke in a particular way. And that whole life was kind of disguised from people. So if you got to know me, you'd get to know me in sections. And when I got involved in the Sangha, I was able to kind of bring everything in. It was a fantastic relief. I remember telling this order member, unfortunately he died a few years ago, and he used to pick me up and take me to the centre. And I said, listen, I've got something to tell you. And he said, so what is that? And I said, I told him that I was gay, and I'd not had a very good experience of being gay and religion, because I'd been brought up as a Roman Catholic. And he said, yeah, so what is it, you know, you want to say? It was like, is that it? So it was a relief. It was like Buddhism was saying, well, the whole of you can come in. rather than some of you can come in, but the rest needs to stay out there. It was a tremendous kind of relief. So I moved to Manchester, and I worked in the gardening business in Manchester. I didn't know anything about kind of gardening. I was a hopeless gardener, and I hated it. And gardening in Manchester is no joke, because it rains a lot. And I'd be meditating in the morning, and I'd hear the rain. I thought, God, I'm going to go out in that. And we'd get wet, we'd get soaked in the morning, have our sandwiches in the back of the van with the grass cuttings, and then we'd go out to work in the afternoon again, wet. But cold and wet rather than warm and wet. We were doing really well. The Sangha was really thriving in Manchester, and we got a lovely big semi-detached house in Chilton, but we couldn't fit everybody in. We were having to turn people away. So we had to get something kind of bigger. And to cut a long story short, we bought a warehouse in the middle of town, in the wrong part of Manchester, in the wrong part of town. And I was chairman at the time, and it was quite scary, because every time we went back, once we'd bought it, every time we went back into it, the warehouse, it got bigger. It was six floors, and it had got dry rot and it had got wet rot. If you know anything about rot, you've got to have wet rot first, and then you get dry rot later. And it was dilapidated, and it hadn't been used, you know, for years. But it had so much potential. So much potential. And we got money to do it up. We had got £49,000 to do it up. To put the heating in, we were going to kind of get second-hand boilers and second-hand radiators. My friend, who wasn't supposed to tell me this, he's a heating engineer, told me that the cost of putting the heating in, you know, cut rate, was going to be £39,000. So that meant we got just a handful of thousand to do the rest of the place up. And we were going to do it ourselves. We got no experience. So the person who put the boilers in and the central heating in had never done any plumbing before. And the person who wired the electrics in, all six floors, had never done any electrics before. And I was the chief plasterer. I was chairman and plasterer. I did a lot of plastering at the centre. Plaster is very, very heavy if you're doing ceilings. I don't know if anybody's done any kind of plastering here. We had a team of Buddhist builders. We had a team of women builders. We had a team of men builders. And in this huge kind of warehouse. In a way, the theatre reminds me of the warehouse on a much smaller scale. Moksha Priya, who was the foreman, told me that we would get this done in a few weeks. I was so naive. It took 2 years to do it, and it was a strain. It was wonderful, because we weren't just going for coffees and walking around the park anymore, you know, in the Sangha. We were working together, and we were learning. We had to learn. This is where learning comes in again. We had to learn how to do things. You can't put electrics in, you know, and them not kind of be safe, and they have to work. You know, we didn't want to kind of, you know, switch on a light and the central heating come on. We had to do it. We had to kind of do it properly. God, it was such a big learning curve, and it was such a kind of a risk. And my treasurer would come to me, and he'd say, "Entrepreneur, we have no money, and the bills are coming in. What are we going to do?" He said it a lot stronger than that. "What are we going to do?" And I said, "Calm down." In here, my heart was going, "Calm down." It's really good having a really anxious person with you, because you always look calmer in relation to that. There were people were struggling. There were tears. This is the men's team, you know. There were tears.
But
friendships were kind of forged in that. Do you know, it was like a forge. And I remember sitting, we'd sit, you know, and we'd have a tea break, and we'd sit there with these mugs of tea, filthy mugs, you know, and filthy faces, and just loving it. I mean, just loving having a project, you know, like that. And people who were working outside, men, women, would come to the centre in the evening. And they'd done a full day's work, some of these men and women, and they would do hours in the centre in the evening. They get filthy, centre in the evening. Everything became work. Dharma study was actually work. order meetings were work. In the regional order meetings, we worked on the building. And then just as we are getting near the opening, and Sangha Rakshit is going to open it, actually, he was going to open it three times, but we had to keep extending the deadline. The IRA let off a bomb near the centre. And luckily, nobody was killed. It's just a miracle. Nobody was killed in that bomb. But it damaged lots and lots of buildings in the centre. And I remember the architect for the centre. When we were allowed in, we weren't at the police closed off the centre of Manchester. When we were allowed in, he rushed to the centre. And he was so sure the whole of the back wall of the centre would have fallen out. But it didn't fall out. It hasn't fallen out yet. So we had a context. We had a project, you know, for us to work in. And at the beginning of the project, people said, Artapriya, I will work at the centre, but I'm not working any longer than not working more than 5 p.m. in the evening. I'm not prepared to do that, and I need a couple of days off, you know. And then as the centre kind of progressed, people were working, you know, until midnight. The night before Sangha Rakshita came to open the centre, I was up until 2 or 3 in the morning, putting coat hooks on the back of toilet doors. And that is the reason when I gave my introductory talk to Bhante, I was giving a talk about mindfulness, a Zen story about mindfulness, and I couldn't remember the end of it. And it was so embarrassing. It was so embarrassing. Because it was about forgetfulness. The story was about forgetfulness. And we had the media there, and we had everybody there. Oh man, it's not kind of what you wanted. I just tell you one more story from that time. It's Christmas Day. We've been sandblasting the inside of the building, 6 floors of sandblasting, and there was no lift, so we had to take bags of sand, 25 kilos they were, up the stairs, up these creaky wooden stairs, up to the top floor. And then the sandblasters would sandblast in the evening. It was hellish, actually, the sandblasting. It was so noisy, dirty. And then we would put the sand back in the same bags and we would bring them down. And I remember Christmas Day, I was in there. I was on my own in there for some reason. And people had gone home or they were on retreat. And it's all dark and it's Christmas Day and I'm shoveling the sand into the bag. And I'm thinking, oh, God. You know, why did I ever agree to this? You know, and I'm shoving the sand in. And it was like that sometimes. It was wonderful. It was wonderful for friendships, you know, bonding kind of friendships. And it was the best of times. In a way, it was the worst of times. And then I kind of moved. Later, years later, I moved to Windhorse. One of the things that really struck me about Windhorse, there's quite a lot of Windhorse people here, is that they came from all over. They came from all over the world. I think at the time I moved here, there were 21 nationalities, I think. I don't think there was quite as many as now, but there were 21 there. And people had crossed oceans, you know, left everything to come and work at Windhorse. We were a kind of microcosm, not just of the movement, because we have a worldwide movement, not just the movement, but the world. My team at the moment, there are, I don't know how many nationalities, there's quite a few nationalities in my team, and we do very well with all the kind of differences in culture and conditioning. We do remarkably kind of well. I want to talk finally about another example of somebody taking a risk. This time, it's one of the people I met early on in my time here. So this is Sanganatha. Back then he was called Santosh. And I want to tell you a bit about him because his kind of life portrays this kind of adventure, taking a risk, the effects of Sangha. His name means the protector of the Sangha. So I met him quite a few years ago. He arrived in Cambridge in his early 20s. Didn't really know how old he was because his mother had, I think, forged his birth certificate so that he would seem older to get him into school earlier. It's quite a thing that happens in India, I think. Hundreds of, maybe thousands of children all born on the same day. Seems to get them into school. Anyway, he was probably 22, might have been 23. Didn't speak very good English, did he, when he arrived? But he threw himself in, and he was a packer. So the packers pack things to send off to shops around the country, and the stuff is picked by the pickers, and the van men who go around the country selling to little gift shops, big gift shops. They take the orders. So the orders come in, the pickers pick them, and then the packers pack them, and then they send them out. And he started life in a very, very kind of different situation. Sanganath came from an Indian village, and his mother was widowed, I think, when Sanganath was just a year old. So he never knew his father. He's just got this rather faded photograph of his father, who's brought up by his grandfather. And his mother supported the boys, he and his brother, by working as a farm labourer. And they belong to the Dalit class, that is the former untouchable caste or class. They come from that community, and that community is one of the most oppressed kind of people. They're right at the bottom. There are millions of them. I asked him, was it a risk you coming here, Sanganath? He said it was more of an adventure for him, getting out of his village. Coming to England just seemed kind of mythic, almost, I think. I don't think the streets were paved with gold. It was cold, and the English seemed a bit reserved. But it was a major thing, him coming, leaving his mother and his brother, his family and his friends, and for all the injustices and prejudice of the caste system in India, it was still home. So he improved his English, he worked on his English, and the first time we had to have a translator to be able to talk together, but he really improved his English. He got ordained into the order on a very long retreat at Gyuloka. And Sanganath has a strong social conscience. He belongs to a community that has had to fight for their rights, not just as citizens, but as human beings. And the fight still goes on. That prejudice is still very much there. But it is a fight that is non-violent. It is a struggle that is underpinned by Buddhist principles. So Sanganath and his family and his community, many of them converted to Buddhism in the 1950s, and thousands, hundreds of thousands have converted since, become new Buddhists. To break out of the caste system, to have a human life, to be human beings. We take that so much for granted. We live in a kind of liberal society, don't we? But those rights we have, those civil liberties we have, were hard won, actually. by people in the past. So they converted to Buddhism under the leadership and inspiration of Dr. Ambedkar, a man I think who deserves to be as well known as Mahatma Gandhi. Sangharakshita, who founded the order and the movement of which this Buddhist centre is part, was living in India at the time. And he played a big part in helping the new Buddhists understand what they had done. Again, this is another... This points to another quality of the Sangha. Bhante, Sangharakshita, was one man in India. One man is limited with what he can do. With the Sangha, we are much stronger. With one person, you've still got their particular character, their particular personality. With the Sangha, you have got all sorts of different perspectives and approaches. So this is Sanghanath's background, and he strongly felt that he'd like to be involved in the fundraising for those social projects that we finance in India. So there's a charity connected with the movement called Karunaa. You might have heard of Karunaa. You might even have done one of the appeals. I think several people here have done them. And you raise money for social projects and Dharma projects in India. And Sanghanath felt strongly that he wanted to be involved in that. He felt that the people from that community should be involved in the fundraising, not just the recipients. He wanted to be more active in that. He felt it. And this is what he's done. He's now done many Karunaa appeals as a member of fundraising teams and also as a solo fundraiser. Now, I did a Karunaa appeal myself many years ago. And, God, it was the most frightening thing I'd ever done, I think. All you do is you go out in the evening and you knock doors. And you ask people if they'd like to read this leaflet, this pamphlet. That's all you do. Why is it so frightening? but it is, you know, there you are. You've got this street. You've got this pile of leaflets. You knock on the door and you have a moment. They answer the door. You have a moment to connect with this other human being. And talk about comfort zone. What I remember myself doing is trying to fall back on charm. Might be surprised, charm. Persona. But you can't. You need to be authentic. You need to be real. And you need not to be just seeing them as a fundraiser. You need to be seeing them as a human being. They need to be free to give or not give. So the same kind of principles need to be there. Yes, it was challenged me as a communicator. Challenged me in what I thought was authentic. It pushed me into areas I've been careful to avoid until then. When I went out in the evening, actually before I went out in the evening, you have your meal earlier. I'd try and get this food down. And there'd be this knot in my stomach as I went out. And at the end of the evening, I'd be full of energy. I'd be kind of full of energy and enthusiasm. So I left the appeal 8 weeks later, feeling stronger, feeling realer, feeling like a kind of Olympic athlete. Maybe that's... over-egging it somewhat. And you live together. You live together for 6 weeks. You may not know people. You may not know the people you are with on the appeal, but you get to know them. You support them. You encourage each other. You support one another. I've just been going to an appeal in London. There's been a women's appeal in Manchester, a men's appeal in London. And I've been going to lead some study for them. And it's fantastic. The idealism people really pushing out of their comfort zone, and they're doing it freely, and they're doing it because they identify with these other human beings that they have never met and may never meet. And I come into that. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. And you can see Sangha being built on those appeals. Something deeper coming into relationship. So if you had time and you're at a loose end and you want to kind of do something kind of challenging, then think of doing a Karuna appeal. Think of kind of taking that risk. Bhante was asked recently why he thought Karuna appeals were so so helpful to people. And he asked, I think it was a women's appeal that went up to see him, he asked them for their own ideas, and they came up with various ideas, and he said the biggest thing is that you're doing it for others. An act of imagination, you're doing it kind of for others. So I have left my script quite kind of dramatically, so just bear with me for a moment. Oh, yes. All good stuff here. So we need a context. This is what it says here. We need a context. A context that allows us to grow and develop in awareness and responsiveness to others. We need a community based on spiritual friendship that is open to the experience of others, that allows others to participate in it. We need a community that allows other kindred spirits to join us. But I think we in Cambridge, going off script, we need to come up with projects. We need to come up with kind of contexts, big and small, for us to come together and work together. Either, you know, for a short time or a longer time. It is so good to do that. It's a real good way of getting to know people. There are order members in Cambridge, there are mitras in Cambridge, friends in Cambridge. I don't know. By involving ourselves in projects, we would get to know one another. We'd get to know the strengths of one another. We get to know our weaknesses too. So I think if you can think of anything, if you can think of any kind of projects that we could kind of do together, then come up with them. Let's hear what they are. It's so invaluable to do that. This is what my experience in the movement, working in the movement all these years, has told me. You get people together, doing something together, festival together, painting together, running something together. It's fantastic. What happens to them? If this happens, Bhante says, a new consciousness is possible. Something greater than the sum of the parts comes together when you've got people intensively practicing the Dharma, doing projects together. You open up the possibility of something else coming in. Perhaps it's a forerunner of some other way of being and relating when we leave ego clinging behind temporarily. Even to some degree, when a number of us does that, something also emerges that motivates us, which is not the ego, or not so dominated by the ego. In the Buddhist tradition, this is perhaps connected to the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for the sake of all beings. We join the Sangha by degrees, we go forth by degrees, we go for refuge by degrees. To use the metaphor of the ocean, I used it last week, we go into the water to the level to which we are comfortable, but the ocean has a life of itself too, and at some point, you're lifted, aren't you? You're lifted and buoyed up by the ocean. It's good to ask yourself, what scares you? What do you hold back from? What is there still to do? What can you do? What inspires you? What would you love to do? Dream. You need to take risks. We need to face up to the possibility of failure. Sometimes success scares us more. I'm going to finish with a quote from Goethe. Actually, I believe this is a mixture of Goethe and someone else. You might be able to shed light on this after the talk. But this for me communicates that other power, that other element that is released when you decide to move out, move beyond, move into the unknown. I'll finish with this. Until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back, always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment that one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material substance, which no one could have dreamt would have come your way. Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it. Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power and magic in it. Thank you.
It is. We did have stories, but stories more about our own common past of what it is to be the current Triratna Buddhist movement, not so much from the Pali Canon and so on. It was very good for me to hear stories, you know, from Manchester in the early 90s when I first came along. This was going on, and we knew it was going on. I can remember some of these, meeting some of these people who were putting these heroic efforts into that project. And there have been dozens of other projects around the movement in the time that I've been involved. And those stories are part of what Sangha is. They're part of our common, what binds us together. So it's another way of illustrating our common past. But he's done it particularly today to outline the whole theme of risk, of, you know, some of these heroic stories involve big risk for individuals. Yes, vividly told. Earlier part of the talk, and again at the very end, did you notice how he was just firing off a lot of questions directly at us? Quite challenging questions. And yet I felt very comfortable being asked them in the way that they were being asked, but not by the questions themselves. And in a way, this is Artapriya doing what he does: humour, kindness, and imagination. And I'd like to stress that thing. He has a knack for just sort of daring to say, oh, I think this person might be ready to be asked this question now. Well, I hope you felt that way tonight. I find that a very in some ways a safe place to be unsafe. If that's a reasonable way. He also asked a question, though. He said, giving a talk, well, a risky business, what will we do? find any help doing. I was doing what I did last week. Sometimes do this. I sit down and think, what sort of animal is sitting there? I won't tell you the answer of what I came up with either last week or this week, except it was different this week, a different sort of animal. But I'm always reminded of Kenneth Graham's A Wind in the Willows. So there's something. But I just invite you to come and see what animal we've got next week when he comes and talks about echoes from the deep. Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you. We were wondering, Taradasa and I, whether we didn't have this last week, but whether there are any kind of questions before we kind of break, whether you've got any questions or issues coming out of what I've said. I've stumped you. I think there's a danger in when I got involved in the Sangha, my life improved, you know, vastly, and I had the sort of friendships I'd longed for all my life. But then I think you can forget about kind of suffering, you know, the suffering of others, and life improves for you. So I wouldn't want the Sangha to kind of live in a bubble. That isn't Sangha for me. We need to keep very, very alive and aware of other people, the situation kind of other people. And I think too, when you're doing something kind of heroic, when you're doing it, it doesn't feel heroic at all. When I think about Manchester, looking back, I can think, God, those were the days, you know, we did this and we were like that, the golden days. But at the time, God, it was like, there was grit everywhere, you know. Every time I had a shower, there was a little pile of sand at the bottom of the shower. It was, you know, there was grit between people. And with projects, you could start small, couldn't you? You could take on doing something, supporting something. I think when you do that, when you take the first step, new possibilities open up as you move along that. Get together with some friends. Can I just throw in something, a little something? This theatre. You know, we've got theatre here, haven't we? And when we got the theatre, there's an old video of Richard Kato the old chairman talking about it, and we were going to do, you know, we were going to do so much with the theatre, and put cultural events on and plays and, you know, the whole, oh, the dreams. And it's great, you know, to say he's been doing these sort of choral competitions. And I was sitting in here, I think it was last year, might have been last year, and there was a competition and people had, a number of composers had composed things and they were competing, you know, we were voting, weren't we, those of us who came along to that. And it felt like the theatre was being used as a theatre. And I'd like to see more of that. Who's going to do it? Somebody needs to do it. Who's going to do that? Well, you are. You are going to do that. I feel it. I supported a level 2 course here a while ago, and I've done a lot of kind of teaching at centres, you know, over the years, but it was new. There were new people, you know, and so I think it's not like you've got these old projects and then the new. Centres are sort of at the meeting point, aren't they, between Sangha and the world. So I'd like to see more outreach groups, more centres. It may be that some of you can't do that, but you could support courses here. You know, and sometimes we have events here where you know, people present something. Mitra evenings, where some of the mitras talk about their practice, and I really appreciated the depth of some of those presentations. So there are people here who've really got something to give. They just need to find a vehicle, you know, for doing that. And interests may be different. So you might be interested in the environment. So you do something, you get together some friends, you do something to bring that to the attention of the rest of us. I can't do that myself. It's not in the forefront of my mind. Or you've got another particular interest that you'd like to bring more into the Sangha. We talked in Manchester years ago about doing things for, you know, like visiting old people. Old age can be a real time of loneliness and isolation. And we're getting old. I'm getting more and more of a sense of that. And it would be really good if we could give something to the wider community, help the wider community in some way. Having just given the talk, my mind is busy. I'm a bit tired now, but would love to see people being able to contribute what they can contribute. Does it mean? Can we leave it there?
Thank you very much.